Blog Talk Radio.
Open this evening so that we can have interplay in our discussion, and we will only shut the mic off if there is interference in the background. Tuesday, June 26th. Will America miss the opportunity once again to save the children of color, which mirrors the first failures, that is, the Native American genocide, the second failure, the failure of slavery, and now we're looking at the third failure, that is the failure of protecting children of immigrants and protecting the whole question of immigrants. But before I get into that, what I believe, the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes, who once protected us in our community, do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up, now is the time. That's my introductory statement. And when I say wake up, I say wake up to the reality that we are failing the people who gave their all for our existence, for our ability to speak out and to talk about injustices. They are in the death camps due to their bravery and willingness to act. And the program, Will America Again Miss Its Opportunity to Save the Children of Color? Well, every day we learn more about our history or the American history. That is not because we're stupid. It is because this history is hidden. And it was just about a month ago where I heard about a situation where the indigenous children, you know, they took them as a matter of course to de-Indianize them and to make them into I don't know what, but to take what they had, their culture and their history. And I know, and I always thought for many years that these things happened a long time ago, until up on the reservation, that is the Akwesasne Reservation, up where we have a home next to the reservation, where I met people who were raped daily in those Indian schools by members of the cloth. And you know that story. And then we go to the story slaves. Children being ripped from their parents and sold. Ripped from their parents and the parents were sold. Etc., etc., etc. And now we're looking at it one more time, and the situation is the same. Because those people who are talking about the tragedy of American history that would have happened over the years are telling us to, they're telling us that it's a terrible thing that has happened, but at the same time that they're telling us that it's a terrible thing that happened, they're going to be telling us to vote for somebody who's going to continue this. I'm talking about the liberal mind in America. They're going to create these situations where they'll talk about the lesser of two evils, and they'll talk about how evil Trump is. And I must remind everybody that Trump couldn't exist if the evil did not exist before he came. He just took advantage of the existing evil. And this is election time again. And the same people who talk about these faults of America are going to ask us to vote again for the same people and the same governments who created this situation. And this brings me to today. We have the people who are speaking out against racism, and you know it's going to be dangerous speaking out against the government nowadays. They have the new category of, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but I know it's bad. Black identity, whatever they call it, are going to be dangerous and are going to be arrested. But if we self-censor and we stop speaking truth, then the truth will be pushed further back from our minds. And I was just watching an interview by Michael Bennett, the great football player from the Seattle Seahawks who was traded to the Eagles, who were disinvited to the White House. And he has written a book, and he's very eloquent. Many times athletes and artists speak out, but they do not speak out with sense of history. It seems that this Michael Bennett has a great sense of history. And his title of his book is Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. And it is interesting. He's an eloquent spokesperson, and he talks about the life of a African-American athlete. And he talks about the importance of athletes speaking out. And he talks about the importance of looking at an athlete as another person. And he used his notoriety to speak out against what's happening. And but it's just another voice to be added to the voices throughout history who have been speaking out. And I'm thinking, when talk about the trauma that is created by tearing a child away from a parent. Well, Mordecai Johnson told us about this trauma in 1948 at Howard University in Washington, D.C., at a graduation event, when he said, if white America ended racism today, this was in 1948, it would take 100 years for black people to overcome the trauma of racism. The trauma that created by racism. And so we hear it today. We say, well, you know, does Trump understand the trauma that they create? Of course they understand it. And somebody said to me, well, Ralph, you're always talking about slavery. You're always talking about history. Talk about today. I said, well, you're right. I'm going to talk about today a little bit. How about miseducation? Children in the inner cities not getting educated. And it gets stranger and stranger every day. And they deny black people, black children, entrance. This is New York City. They deny us entrance into the specialty schools. So they create a black school of their own in a black neighborhood. And they exceed, they excel in this school. What does the Board of Ed do? They want to change the school. They have babies in another district in Brooklyn. They excel. I'm talking about first grade, second grade. What do they want to do? They want to change it. So therefore, you have to conclude, is this by accident or is this by design? And so we have this program where we're facing a history that is outrageous. And the question is, what are we going to do? And on this program, what we do is we speak out for those brothers and sisters who had the courage and the willingness to do something about the continued death. And I tell you that the young man, 17 years old, in East Pittsburgh, who was in a minor auto accident, who was got out of his car and ran from the police, only to be gunned down in the back. The only thing that has changed is we have a young person with a camera, with a cell phone, who took the video and said it looked like that policeman was taking target practice. And that policeman will not be charged with anything due to some of the people, like our so-called liberal mayor, de Blasio, no excuse for speaking out or fighting against the policemen. And our Governor Cuomo, no excuse. Anybody who fought against the police, and I say, because you misnamed police, they are the army of occupation in the black community. And anybody who wanted to change the black community would find that. And I have to hold myself back when somebody says the parents don't care. What a crock of you know what. Because the parents cared and they came out and they fought for their children. And the point came where the city made it obvious that the next step, the police were going to use guns, brutality. They beat you. Any parent knows that they're not welcome in the PTA meetings. And I was there. We fought that fight. And the next step was guns. We were willing to take guns, but the Negro politicians gave back all of the gains that the people in the street made. So let us stop talking about what the parents don't care. The next step was to take up arms against the sea of trouble, and the parents weren't prepared emotionally or physically to do so, and so they brought our schools and our communities down. But this is a program, and I've been warned by Sister Betty that she will beat me with a stick if I am on more than 15 minutes, and I'm 4 seconds to the 15 minutes, and so I'm going to ask Ayanna Esselin to introduce our next guest. Ayanna.
Hi. Our next guest is Reverend Larry Pinkney.
No, it is not Reverend Larry Pinkney. It is just Larry Pinkney,
former political prisoner of the Black Panther Party, writer and author of Black Activist Writer Guild. I am sorry.
Okay, Larry, your microphone is open, and we're still learning.
Thank you very, very much, and don't worry about it. It is what it is, but I'm glad you corrected it. I believe someone last week said, Reverend, I'm not a right reverend, a left reverend, or any kind of reverend. Okay, but so thank you for correcting that. But, you know, let's move on. I'm not going to be on very long. Today was a very difficult day for me. I spent a significant amount of time at the clinic hospital dealing with a number of my own medical issues. What I do want to say is thank you, Brother Ralph, and Sister Professor Betty Davis, who, you know, I miss daily all the time, and, you know, and everyone who is on the show. As I said, I'm going to be very brief, not feeling too great physically or mentally at the moment, but I will be listening in to the show. I also want to thank you both for putting up the article from 2013 that I wrote in the Black Commentator called Embrace the Everyday People's Stories and Reject the Top-Down Narrative of History. And I think Brother Ralph was basically talking about that, among other things. So having said that, I'm going to end, as I often do, by saying that we must free all of our political prisoners. We've had a few victories in the last 2 or 3 weeks, but just a few. We've got so much more work to be done. Our political prisoners have fought for us, have given everything, everything, black, white, brown, red, and yellow. They have given everything to the people. So I'm going to end at that. I look forward to listening. As I said, sorry I can't go on, not feeling too great, but I'll be listening very intensely to everyone coming on. I'm looking forward to hearing Brother Raymond Nat Turner, listening to Sister Ann Lamb, listening to Brother Tom and Brother Joel, and whoever else will be on the show. All power to the people. Thank you very, very much. Stay strong, folks.
Thank you so much for that, Larry. And we're going to move on. The next mic we're going to be calling on is 916-4058. Your mic is open.
Yes. Yes, you're right. 916, that's peace, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. I am Tyreek. I am a Black Panther. I am a former Black Liberation Army prisoner of war. I spent 17 years in various American death camps. Tonight, I want to talk about the Supreme Court decision and about racist principal Patricia Cantania. The Supreme Court decision. The long-awaited United States... Huh? Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, I can.
The long-awaited United States Supreme Court decision on President Donald Trump's ban on persons traveling to America from 7 predominantly Muslim countries was issued today. The United States Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, decided that the president's ban does not exceed his authority, nor does it discriminate against Muslims. I was not able to predict what the court would decide. However, I am sure the Supreme Court decision was the best decision that will enable the ruling class to do what they intend to do going forward. In making their decision, the court says they will not address the most important issue. That matter is that the people attempting to enter the United States are attempting to escape conditions of extreme poverty and or conditions of extreme violence. In either case, the condition that prompted the people to leave was brought about by the United States ruling class or some other foreign ruling class installing a gangster government in a country. that gangster government was subjecting the people to extreme exploitation through low wages, or that gangster government is in a shooting war with their indigenous population. The installing of the gangster government is what is prompting people to attempt to escape to America. Additionally, that is the case of those persons coming from Central America who are separated from their children. We revolutionaries must shine light on what is key in both of these matters. Regarding Principal Patricia Cantania, this morning, Brother Shepherd McDaniel and three other persons and I took the occasion of the last day of school to say that the principal of Middle School 224, Patricia Cantania, should not come back to that school next year. Patricia Cantania told a black teacher she should not teach black history. We made it clear that teaching black history saves lives. I pointed out that our young people who learn about Africa, about Harriet Tubman, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, and Frederick Douglass do not kill other black people. They positively contribute to humanity. I went on to say that group of young people who killed Junior was a young person killed outside of a bodega in the Bronx, had not been taught black history. I further said racists know black people who know our history do not kill other people, and that is why racists do their damnedest to keep African history out of the public school system. Learning black history is a serious matter of life or death. To be free, we need the appropriate information. Free all prisoners of war. We are watching what is going on with Robert Seth Hayes. As you know, he is a political prisoner, and he passed out, and we were told that he was taken to an outside hospital. Thank you for listening to me, Ralph, and the other persons. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. And my granddaughter is here helping me with the computer, Ayanna Esseline. And to continue with your thoughts of teaching history, we're going to go to 347 and the last digits 1959. Your mic is open.
This is Reverend Juan Carlos Ruiz from the New Sanctuary Coalition here in New York City, where since 2007 we've been educating, resisting, and basically telling anybody who could listen that the apparatus of Homeland Security is a machinery that is separating our families and destroying our communities. We believe that the immigration issue is a humanitarian crisis. Thus, you know, it doesn't only affect the immigrant, but it's also stealing the soul of the person that has the keys and locks people away. We do believe that we have to divorce this security apparatus from the immigration is being forced upon our people. You know, it's a $20+ billion business, this Homeland Security that has been created since 9/11. And we do need to denounce that at this point, you know, any immigrant and any other than the doesn't look like the dominant culture is seen as a threat to this society. Once that person is labeled as a threat, this whole apparatus of security is unleashed upon that person. So we do denounce that, you know, in the 1900s, immigration was under the Department of Labor. I think we need to start reimagining, rethinking how we are managing immigration, because at this point it's just an extension of the whole military, hyper-militarization in our community. We invite you to, if you want to be part of this movement here in New York City, we invite you to check us out, www.newsanctuarynyc.org.
Well, thank you so much for that, Reverend. We, as you have pointed out, it is an economic situation as well as a moral, immoral situation. And as Lynn Stewart said, capitalism is such a thing that will make anything that makes money tolerated. And to keep the immigrants frightened keeps people from organizing. And the capitalist system is very much into that, and we see it in all of its form in what's happening today. And following that, we're going to have to go to Sister Kolya, who your mic is open.
Yeah, good evening, Brother Rack, Brother Betty. Good evening to everyone that has spoken, including Brother Pinckney, who was always on my mind, and that his great warriorship in the Midwest will live on beyond our times. You know, Rack, you said something that's very, very important. In fact, and not only that, when you talked about this need to go back to the Dawes Commission of 1872, and I think we probably need to go back to the Monroe Doctrine of 1822, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a nation that was designed as a republic from its inception to create genocide and destruction as it went forward to build a European empire in these Western hemisphere. That is what we're talking about. And we need to put these things in perspective. So when we're talking about teaching black history, for example, to teach black history is to teach American history. Not possible
exactly.
To teach American history without it. But as we go back, we should also remember something that Thomas Jefferson said, because these demons may do things, but the demons also bring things out of their mouths that is important that we should have been listening to and trying to deal with across the last couple of centuries. Thomas Jefferson said clearly that there should be a revolution every 20 years, an armed struggle. That is what he said. And we've been trying to avoid that because none of us want pain. Nobody wants to shoot up anybody. Nobody wants to throw dynamite or do whatever. And yet we are dynamited and we are shot up and we are imprisoned. We've got these small groups sitting down on that Mexican border, 3,200 people, hiding the fact that young girls, and you can find everybody down there but young teen girls, where did they go? We've only seen one instance on television, and that was some teen girls at a school down in Florida, because those young teen girls are in Trump's trafficking machine with his Russian whoever, already set up, Trump towers and everything else all around this country. They are being trafficked. Black girls are already being trafficked every day. So that small number of people sitting on that border down there. And the press is part of the machinery, so what are they hiding? What they're hiding is that as you and I tonight on this program, white farmers in the United States are committing suicide en masse because they cannot afford to live in the present economy. That's one of the things that they're hiding. The other thing that they're hiding is that the white population rates have fallen so low they can't afford to have any fair-skinned Latins come across that border. Any fast skin coming from anywhere, actually, I don't think they'll take any too many from Europe, coming across that border is a threat to the local ones who are killing themselves off in one way or the other, and now the rest of us must pay the price. So we need to look at that. Today, we looked at the Supreme Court, which is turning back all of the voting rights gains won by blacks primarily blacks and some liberal whites who fought with us in the 1960s, a few Latins and a few red. But that's being turned back. We see two great decisions, one in Ohio where they're saying that the state actually has a right. And by the state now, we're talking really talking about a Republican state, a Republican-controlled state that has a right to remove folk from the voting rolls who have not voted in the last 6 years, or to remove votes from the voting rolls who did not respond to notices that were sent out. So we see that happening. We see a Texas case that is very similar, where Latins are not allowed to move into the political process and elect candidates because they're doing a similar kind of thing. So we go through where we are now, and we must do that, and we must do that looking back at the Monroe Doctrine designed to destroy Central and South America and the Caribbean by asserting that America had a right to control the area. So we've got to go back there and go back there and looking at it from where we are now, standing where we are now, going back, taking in mind the brothers talking about teaching history, because to teach history is to teach the truth. To teach the truth. So if we go back to from where we are now, we will notice that we have stripped Latin America of its land. We have stripped Latin America of its mineral rights, all through what? American agreements. We're talking about CAFTA, we're talking about NAFTA. We're talking about the ways in which we've used the World Bank, and we're talking about the ways in which we have used our political clout, our economic clout, and our military power to actually destroy these people so that they cannot make a living at home. Because we should not be encouraging people to come here.
We
shouldn't be doing
that. Thank you so much, Colium, because one of the things that I forget who said it, the philosopher who said, no one leaves home unless they're living in the mouth of a shark.
Amen.
As you stated, people, America has created mouths of sharks in the country as they rape their natural resources and control their economies through the World Bank. And so they leave from the mouth of the shark to come here to a country they are have been told lies about that they believe. They know, as a young man who worked with me said to someone telling him, why doesn't he go back to his country? And his answer was very simple and very plain. You, your country, have come to my country and brought everything from my country to this country. I come here to get a little bit of it back. And this is the story. And we go further to who is responsible for these Supreme Court decisions? That swing vote. Clarence Thomas. Who supported Clarence Thomas? Where did the money come from to support Clarence Thomas's attempt to become a Supreme Court justice? Right-wing Christians in America, Israel, and South Africa, and Negro preachers in the South intimidated liberals to accept this, I don't know what you would call him, but he is
there
the
swing
vote.
Calling.
Okay, he has been the swing vote, and no one has taken responsibility for that yet. When they talk about playing the race card was played against us, and with that, I'm going to have to move on, and I believe Sister Ann is in the house. Sister Ann, are you in the house?
Yes, I am. I have just arrived in the house.
Pleasure,
as always, to be with you. As you know, since it has become public knowledge, I think we can say that Robert Seth Hayes, who has been in prison since 1973, finally made the parole board shortly ago on his 11th hearing. He received a split 2-1 decision to be released. He has an open release date of July 24th. We're trying to find out why he has an open date and not an exact date. We have not been told the answer to that question yet. However, yesterday I received a call from one of his friends to let me know that Seth once again had fallen out in his cell and had been rushed out in an ambulance on an emergency basis to the hospital. Hi. Now, we did not know which hospital. We did not know if he was at Catskill Regional, which is the closest one. We didn't know if he was Albany Medical Center, which is the better one. Okay. It turns out he is at Albany Medical Center, which in a way is a relief because I know he gets good medical care there. We don't know what precipitated this, if his sugars were high, if his sugars were low. You know, they won't give you any information. If you call the medical, so if you call Sullivan, of course I did, they say, oh, well, he's at Albany Medical Center, and you can call them if you want. Yes, okay. And then if you call Albany Medical Center, they are not allowed to release any information about a patient who is a prisoner. I was also informed by the patient information people that he would not even be in their computer system and that I would, of course, have to speak to docs. So I called back Sullivan to speak to Seth's counselor, who, of course, was not at her desk. I did finally speak to her at about 1 p.m., just to be told, of course, that Seth is at Albany Medical Center, and that was all they could tell me. So until and when he gets back, he can't make phone calls from there. So until he gets back, we will not know exactly what happened, but I would assume that this will also delay his release date. So we have to be vigilant at all times. He's still in their power. He will be in their power until the day he walks out the door. Even after that, he will still be in their power because he'll be on parole with all kinds of restrictions. But, you know, right now he is totally in their power in terms of medical and everything else. So we have to always be vigilant and always be on watch until, you know, our people come home. So hopefully we'll have some news soon. Floyd did call me again today, his friend, to let me know that they did confirm that he was at Albany Medical Center, so I thanked him for that. So, you know, it's important that it's good to know our comrades have friends who look out for them on the inside and, you know, try to see to their every need, and that's very important. We also have some news about Sundiata Okoli. I think, as people know, Sundiata Okoli is Asada Shakur's co-defendant. Sundiata will be 82 in January, okay? Mm. He is a Jersey State prisoner, but he's being held in the feds. We have a couple of those cases. Imam Jamil Alameen is a Georgia State prisoner who's being held in the feds. Anyway, he was taken to New Jersey at the end of May, supposedly for a parole hearing on June 8th. His lawyers are finally, hopefully, going to be able to see him this week and find out, you know, from him what's going on, and he can find out from them what's going on. But anyway, he's there, and he's been there since the end of May. And luckily, we have our friend Bonnie Kerness, who is in New Jersey, you know, longtime person working around the issue of prisons, isolation, solitary, and so on. So she has contact with other prisoners where he is, and she says they have taken care of his every need. The only thing they have not gotten for him yet is a TV, and they're working on that. So, you know, in terms of any, you know, special food or books to read or newspapers or all that, he's being totally taken care of. The thing is that we don't know particularly why he is being there for such a long time. So hopefully we'll have an answer to that. And Bonnie also said people should understand that New Jersey is like saying you're in Angola in Louisiana. New Jersey is horrible. They have the worst parole board in the country, all well known. You know, Sundiata should have been out on parole a long time ago. And he's not, only because the FOP and, you know, the vituperative hatred that they always display, especially toward him, because he is Asada's co-defendant, and Asada is safe in Cuba, and they can't touch her. So they take it out on Sundi. So as soon as we have any more news on that, I will be reporting in on both those issues. You know, it's really serious that we really always need to be paying attention, because we see what's going on out here with all the stuff with the immigrants and everything else and the Supreme Court upholding the Muslim ban and so on and so forth. But let's not forget that all these things that they're doing publicly, they've also been doing privately inside their prisons for many, many, many years. And today is also the International Day Against Torture. So we should remember that our prisoners are suffering some form of psychological or physical torture almost every day.
Well, thank you so much for that, Ann.
We must bring them home. Thank you, Ralph.
Yes, bring them home. And as the news got out about what was happening with Seth, we heard people saying, "Let us ride now, up to the prison or up to the hospital. Let us stop making phone calls or continue making phone calls." But Raza Khan from Philly says, "I'll meet you at the steps of the hospital." We must start being proactive with our political prisoners. And next we'll go to Tom Syracuse. Tom, are you in the house? Are you in the house?
Ann?
All righty.
Is Ann still on the phone?
Yes, I'm still on the phone, Tom.
Can you give me your email?
Yes, it's nycjericho@gmail.com.
nycjericho.
J-E-R-I-C-H-O at gmail.com.
Gmail. Thanks a lot, Ann.
Thank you.
I sent a I just wrote an article entitled "The Great American Myth."
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that unless we understand our history, we're not going to be able to understand what's going on today.
Right.
And so I'm forwarding it to everybody that I know here on the blog. Cool. The great American myth is that this country was founded as a democracy, and that despite ups and downs, it is still a democracy. But the American Revolution of 1775 was essentially a political revolution led by merchants, land speculators, and slave owners, who were limited by the British government from expanding their power. This American colonial elite had to import products in British ships from England at prices determined by British exporters who blocked competitive exports from other countries, a system referred to as mercantilism. The British also prevented Americans, including the landless poor, from settling beyond the Appalachian Mountains, because this threatened the lucrative British fur trade with the indigenous people in that region. The taxes that the British Parliament levied on the colonials to help pay for the previous French and Indian wars were relatively little, but gave the colonialists a popular issue. Quote, "Taxation without representation." Another convenient issue to rationalize revolt against established authority was to characterize the king as a tyrant. But by the reign of George III, real power was exercised by Parliament. And actually, the colonists practiced a significant amount of local self-rule. After successfully defeating Britain by 1783, with crucial French help, the 13 former colonies faced serious problems. The 13 colonies became a loose confederation of independent states, each with its own currency, interstate tariffs, militias, and even abilities to make separate foreign treaties. This complicated trade and the development of domestic industry within the states. Amendments to the Articles of Confederation had to be unanimously approved. Voting for each state's government was limited to white males who owned property. However, the majority of these voters were small family farmers who began to control the state governments. They started to cancel the debt owed to wealthy Americans incurred during the Revolution. Individual states did not have well-organized or strong militias to attack the indigenous in order to take their lands or to easily put down rebellions, such as the Farmers' Rebellion, called Shays' Rebellion. The slave population accounted to more than 18% of the entire population. In South Carolina, it was 45%. Virginia, 39%. Maryland, 32%. Thousands of slaves were fleeing to Florida, at that time still a Spanish colony. In fact, Spain had enlisted escaped black slaves in its attacks on the British colonies of Georgia and South Carolina before the American Revolution, although Spain itself was a major slave-holding empire. Well, all of this motivated the wealthy elite in the newly independent American states to call a constitutional convention in Philadelphia in 1787. But the United States was never founded as a democracy, but rather as a racist plutocracy based on African slavery and indigenous genocide, despite the words of the Declaration of Independence. Quote, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And these are the words in the preamble to the Constitution. Quote, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. These words sound truly inspirational and progressive until one realizes that the phrase, quote, to ourselves and to our posterity, referred to white men who own property. The concept of democracy was never mentioned. In fact, many of the founding fathers, such as James Madison, considered democracy as mob rules. The checks and balances in the Constitution are really ways of checking majority rule. And this plutocratic document, so revered by most Americans, would not have been accepted by all the states until the Constitution was amended to protect individual rights in 1789. These 10 amendments are known as the Bill of Rights. Although subsequent amendments were ratified, abolishing slavery, extending civil rights and the franchise to all adult citizens, the plutocracy never weakened and has gotten stronger as industrial capitalism morphed into a corporate financial imperialist capitalism that puts profit ahead of everything else. And this has created such huge wealth and power among the few that they have been able to totally corrupt the social and political system, a process that began from the founding of this so-called republic. The development of democracy, social justice, racial equality, peace, and the solution to the environmental crisis cannot take place within profit-driven capitalism. To think that we can reform capitalism by somehow reviving an earlier form based on family farms and small business ignores the historical process of capitalism. So what real progressives need to do is to convince the public why capitalism does not work, so that when it does collapse, the public is not hoodwinked by some fascist savior. Mm-hmm. And this leads to the question, how do we get beyond the corporate-controlled mass media? Right now, left progressives communicate mostly with each other, the choir preaching to the choir, and they are bogged down in their own sectarianism.
But
thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that history lesson.
Yeah.
we all need that history lesson. We all need reminded of that history lesson. But I'm going to open the mic. Joe, are you with us?
Oh, yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I can hear you.
Hello.
What are your words of wisdom this
Well, I think that was a really great presentation. And, of course, it can be used to put the whole immigration question in its context, because this is a country that was, they had two uses for immigration. I mean, there were two facets of immigration. One is to bring in an invading force to transform what existed before into what it is now, which is a dictatorship of big money, of the bankers and major corporations, and but it was a process that took a few hundred years, and that process included encouraging massive immigration in order to crush the native peoples that were in this country, to overwhelm and crush them, and then use various technological advantages to commit military genocide and land theft based on that genocide, which was the real seed of wealth of not only capitalism in the United States, but as it consolidated itself in Europe. This theft of this land, this conversion of land that was just the source of food and space to live and so on, was converted instead into capital, and the rest is history. Then once they have the type of immigration that they wanted to crush the native peoples, then they want to turn it out and prevent immigration from those who very often have been victimized by this group from a domestically genocidal country against the native peoples and against the African people, especially those who had been enslaved. Then it took this and it spread this corrupted wealth around the world and grew from this early capitalism into late-stage capitalist imperialism. And that's the system that we live in now. And as Ralph pointed out before, many of the countries that are the sources of pressure to immigrate, it's because they're living in countries that were largely destroyed, whose resources have been totally stolen, whose natural economies have been crushed by these capitalist imperialist impositions. And then the wealth is taken from those countries, concentrated in the imperialist countries. And then we think of, some people say, well, look, the Democrats are strange, because I'm talking about the leadership level of them, that they impose imperialist enslaved living, and yet they're for why Social Security and unemployment insurance, which Republicans very often are opposed to. But the two things are interdependent, because a system which is based on exploitation, in order to give the more they rob from the rest of the world, the more they can make the relatively exploited people in this country feel still privileged. Well, you don't have to live like people live in Latin America. You have a higher standard of living, and you have all this clothing that's made in Asia, all this part of this wealth actually trickles down. So it's a way of cultivating not only a pro-imperialist attitude in terms of robbing the rest of the world, but then even a military attitude and a racial attitude that, well, if we have all this wealth and those other people, look, they're not as wealthy as we are. There must be something superior about us. So it's very not just the, you know, we like to talk about the top lawyers that actually call the shots, but it also corrupts a lot of people through the so-called middle class. That word middle class actually has that appeal to it. You're in the middle. You're not like Rockefeller.
Well, Joel,
level, but yes.
Very well taken. And I hate to interrupt because you're giving us so much information. It kind of reminds me of sitting in a college course on history, political sciences program. And I'm going to have to go to Gwen Goodwin to give us some local news possibly or tell us what's happening with her. Gwen, your microphone is open.
Hi, everybody. And this has been a great show tonight. It really has been. It sounds to me like the first radio I've listened to this week that has any sanity to it at all. So I am going to talk about local stuff. And what I'm going to first comment is on the local leadership that got all their faces in front of the camera up here in East Harlem where I live to exploit the situation with these children who
yep.
have already been traumatized. And they thought it was a really great thing to go and, you know, then have a protest in front of this place where these kids are already shaken up because, you know, it was all about the politics. But the most over-the-top lies I heard this week was Melissa Mark Viverito being on WNYC with Brian Lehrer. And it was just so outrageous, the amount of lies she was able to get away with. And, you know, they dragged her out because they haven't known what to do with her. And they put her up on this, you know, they put her on this radio show because she speaks Spanish. And it was hysterical to hear her talk about that she also came to America for a better opportunity. Now, let me just tell you something. Melissa herself is an immigrant to Puerto Rico, where her parents are. Both of her parents are born in America. Her father was part owner of San Juan Hospital. And when he died, he left her about $3 million. But she came to New York, according to her, to get a better opportunity. Well, that was the buying of the city council, because her godfather is head of 1199, Rivera. So this is how Ms. Viverito climbed her way to the top. First being living in the West Village, then coming up here and getting this seat bought and paid for. So the next thing I heard her say was this wonderful partnership with Mayor Bloomberg, because first she gave the listener a lecture on the Koch brothers and how terrible it was, all the money they pumped into politics. And she is for democracy. She believes in true democracy. So she said she was thrilled that Mayor Bloomberg, another great Democratic figure, was going to get on board and donate $80 million to only Democrats. And they were going to be donating it to her, too, in her victory party. So I'm sitting here listening to this, and Brian Lehrer says, well, are you familiar with the place that's taking Cayuga, who's taking in these immigrant children? And she says, well, not really, because they came in late. You know, they came in 2014. And she said, remember, I just became speaker. It was hysterical. She had been in office for 8 years already. And she came in with the lowest score of any person getting back into the city council, but she didn't know about this place until 2 days ago. And this place is pretty much right in the heart of East Harlem. It's not really, you know, it's not really hiding anywhere. And the interesting thing to me is that whenever a not-for-profit comes in, they always have to come through the community board. And it's always a big deal. So, you know, I was really surprised to hear her use her lack of not knowing it as because she wasn't the city council speaker yet. So apparently 8 years in city council, I guess she don't do anything. And, you know, when she finally got that new position of the council speaker, well, that's apparently, according to her, was when she really came into, you know, being a council person. So I listened to all this on the radio, and I was stunned by the lack of questions that Brian Lehrer had asked her. Now, I have been calling all week and requesting to speak on that show because I wanted to bring up exactly what everybody else has brought up, and that is the devastation of these countries through American policies and the reason why. I don't think we can have a conversation about immigration unless we're going to talk about the reasons why people are coming to America. And I agree with everyone who said tonight that these places are broken through our policies. You know, look at John Perkins' book.
you there, Gwen.
There you go.
Wonderful hearing from you. And I hope everybody comes back in August. We're taking the month of July off, and we're going to play these programs at this hour.
Excellent.
Month of July. And happy summer, and the work we have to do. And Gil is out there, and the what's his name is filled. And Gil, can you just say a few words about the work you'll be doing throughout this summer?
Well, I mean, there isn't really time. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll mention August 30th, but I had a lot more I wanted to say about moving Mumia today. You're saying there's no shows until August?
No shows until August. We're taking.
Okay. Well,
we're going to let you
August,
go first.
August.
Next. We're going to take off 4 weeks.
Okay. Why don't I come back on that show? But I'll just please save the date, August 30th, Thursday, August 30th. We're going back to Philadelphia for Mumia's hearing. It's really important. This may be our last chance to reopen the case, his case, based on the failure of Judge Castile to recuse himself in his appeal.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. We'll be leaving at 5:30 in the morning from 147 West 47th Street, the Solidarity Center, and you can find out
Street,
more.
West 24th Street.
West 24th Street, and you can find out more about getting on the bus at freemumia.com.
All right.
Thank you so much for that. See you all in August. Thanks.
Love you and have a great summer.
I'll see you before that on July 3rd. And Nat Turner's thing.
All the change.